Charlie Trotter is possibly one of the most widely acclaimed chefs in the whole entire world, but that's only the beginning of the story, the chef part, I mean. Welcome, Charlie, to On the Menu.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be with you guys today.
Well, I mean, when I said this is just the start, I mean, you are a teacher, you are a mentor, you are you have a takeout restaurant, you have a culinary foundation, you do all this philanthropic work, you television shows, you write books. I don't know where you find the time.
Well, it's me and my 45 assistants.
Oh, you have?
And that's how we do things. No, I'm teasing. We have a great team, and, you know, it's not just me out there doing all these things by myself. We have great sous chefs and pastry chefs and dining room leaders and sommeliers and a variety of folks that all have different sets of responsibilities. So that's the key to everything.
And so you're very well organized.
Well, our team is very well organized. All I do is point with my eyes, give a few directions, and they do the rest, and they say, Chef Trotter, if you could just stand over there and get out of the way, we'll make it happen, and they make me look good. So,
curiously,
as good as I can look. Anyway.
Curiously, when we asked Thomas Keller what the secret of his success was, he said it was teamwork, and I think you would probably say exactly the same thing.
Absolutely. It's like a great sports team. You know, you think of a team like the Los Angeles Lakers in the 80s with Magic Johnson, and he was a guy that got everybody involved, or the Bulls with Michael Jordan, and it was, you might have one or two people that are just extraordinary, but without everybody else, you couldn't win the championship, and that's how we look at things. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of people that have very important and key roles, and I just happen to be sort of the face, in a sense, but everybody does a great job.
Now, you started out as a political scientist.
Well, I first went off to academic life, thinking possibly I'd go on to graduate school, and wasn't really sure. I became less enamored with that kind of lifestyle. I studied political theory and philosophy, and decided not to go to graduate school. I was cooking for my roommates at the time. This was in the early 80s, late 70s, up in Madison, Wisconsin. And I really loved cooking. I loved the sort of physical attributes and the central component, and I decided I think I might want to be a cook. And, hey, what's the worst that can happen? If I do this for a couple of years and I'm not very good at it or I don't like it, I can always go back to graduate school, right, or go to law school or something like that. So
it's a scary.
But my first day on the job, I fell madly in love with the whole thing. And here I am today. I don't know how many years later, I'm still a cook. I mean, I'm more of a cook than a chef. That's how I look at myself.
Very few chefs do that anymore, look at themselves as cooks.
Think of it this way, Charlie. If you'd stayed in political science, maybe we'd be talking to you as President Charlie instead of President Obama.
Or you might be talking to me as President Obama's lead cook down in the kitchen.
Well, there's probably...
He studied the same field of work, but he knows how to cook, so maybe I'll plug him in, and I can, when I'm eating with the family, I can bend his ear about some things.
one of the words I think that many people would use in describing Charlie Trotter is meticulous, and nowhere is the lesson of meticulousness clearer than in a book called Lessons in Wine Service. So why don't we start there?
Well, thank you for that question. Lessons in Wine Service is the third and final volume of a three-part management, or more, I don't like the word management, but leadership series of books. And we emphasize leadership all the way around our organization. Number one rule is you work for me, for sure, but forget that. Most importantly, you work for yourself. And the only degree of success in life comes from when you have your own highest standards. And you may have a boss, you may have a supervisor, but if you understand the idea that your own expectations and standards for yourself have to be even higher than those around you, any leader, anyone else, then you will ultimately become a leader. So we try to consider our organization as a breeding ground for creating leadership. The book, Lessons in Wine Service, continues along a path of focusing on a number of things that happen in a certain realm of the experience of service. There was Lessons in Excellence, the first book, which, even though it features ideas from our restaurant or a restaurant per se, those ideas can be adapted to all sorts of businesses. And that's kind of the fun part about it, because when we get a business leader in, a CEO of a Fortune 500 company or any other kind of leader, and they say, you know what, your book is really fantastic. There are so many ideas in there, even though they're specific to your restaurant, they apply to my business. I brought 50 copies for my staff.
Oh, that's
wonderful.
That's
how we started with that book. But we continued with Lessons in Service, which went right to the core of just service. I mean, literally playing the game of chess where you're trying to outthink the client. You're trying to do things for the client before they even have a chance to ask for something. And so you're observing things. You're overhearing things. You are perceiving things. You are looking at things. And you are deriving ideas and figuring out things to do for a client, a guest, before they even have a chance to ask for those things. Lessons in Wine Service, as I said, the final part of the series focuses specifically on the area of wine, although there are ideas that expand beyond just wine. But it's really for the wine connoisseur at home or for the professional. A lot of our books are written for professionals.
Yeah, this book is obviously targeted in that direction, although I've been enjoying looking at it because it also teaches me about things about wine that I didn't know. But let's start with the story close to the front of the book. I think it's really a fascinating book. And you speak of Larry Stone, who worked for you, who tells this story that you had, I think, a guest who came into the restaurant and he ordered a Chateau Mouton Rothschild, I forget the year, which is a rather outstanding wine, but the guest had ordered lobster to go with it. So Larry came rushing into the kitchen and said, "You'll never guess what happened." So then what did you do, Charlie? You changed the sauce on the lobster?
Well, Larry Stone, for the listeners that I'm quite familiar with him, is easily regarded as the greatest sommelier in America. He was the first sommelier to ever win the World Sommelier Competition in Paris back in 1986. So if you can imagine an American winning the World Sommelier Competition in France, it was probably the equivalent of when Greg LeMond, way before Lance Armstrong, won the Tour de France, an American. That's like, sacre bleu, you know, this is impossible. It's not, you know, American. This is not, we can't even conceive of this. Well, Larry gained worldwide acclaim, and he is, what's so great about Larry Stone, Master Stone, is that he's not just a guy on the floor serving wine, recommending great wine. He's a guy that's intimately involved on the culinary side, so he's always concerned about how the dish can work with the wine. So sometimes the chef will say, well, here's my dish, my lobster dish, or my pigeon dish, or my pasta dish, whatever it may be. You figure out the wine to go with it. But see, wine is fixed, and so when someone orders a certain bottle, maybe they want to get a bottle of Mouton, and maybe it's for a birth year, maybe it's 1959, maybe it's 1982, maybe it's an anniversary wine, whatever it may be. That wine, once you open it and decant it and serve it, it's more or less fixed. Now, it may evolve a little bit over the evening, but it's more or less fixed, whereas food is malleable. You can adjust food. Now, I might have a lobster dish that I have on the menu that would work perfectly with a Gewürztraminer, a lighter, fruitier, a little bit more acidic wine than a Mouton, for sure. But the guest orders the lobster, and he wants to drink Mouton, or she wants to drink Mouton. Well, we can easily adapt that lobster dish to fit the wine.
What did you actually put in it, Charlie?
Well, I think what we did was we made a quick red wine reduction. We added a little quick sauté of wild mushrooms and a few little notes of reduced veal stock. Next thing you know, the lobster dish goes right into red wine territory.
Oh.
And that's the beauty of things like that.
That's amazing.
So. It's a marvelous thing. Now, the book is, I can't really do justice to it, because at the end of each chapter, you have a specific set of notes that says, okay, these are the service points related to what we just talked about. And perhaps you can think of a couple of really good examples of that might be adaptable to someone serving wine at home rather than serving wine in a restaurant, because we have listeners in both camps.
Well, in the end, I always advocate that the wine is fixed, the food is adjustable or malleable. And, you know, once you open that bottle of Pinot Noir or Chardonnay or Grüner Veltliner or whatever it may be, that's fine. But the food, you can add some meat juice, or you can add red wine reduction, or you can lighten it up, or you could add citrus. And you shouldn't be so fixed with the food. I mean, you don't have to be, I don't think you have to overly intellectualize food and wine pairing. But if you want to make a few adjustments, the next thing you know, the dish can work perfectly, superbly with the wine, and then you're on another level altogether.
Yeah, we had an earlier guest on the program, oh, it was a couple of years ago, Evan Goldstein, who you quote liberally in your book.
And Evan's a great personal friend, and he, like Larry, is one of the great geniuses of food and wine pairing.
He's amazing.
And he wrote a book with his mother, Joyce.
Yes, Joyce, who's a good friend of ours.
And he went the same way you did. He said, this is the wine. Joyce, you come up, mother, just come up with a dish that goes with this wine, which is a very similar approach to what you're talking about.
Well, Evan and I appear every year together at the Sante magazine symposium, where they bring together food and wine professionals, and he and I are on stage together, and we do a little exercise in that vein. So we've worked extensively together.
Wow.
Now, one of the most amazing things, I'm in the seasonal food and wine pairing chapter, which is where I think listeners are going to find some very, very interesting things. And I glanced through some of the pairings that you have, and the amazing thing is the breadth of the world coverage of wine that you have. For example, I'm looking at a dish right now, which is an organic dish, organic buttermilk with white pepper, toasted milk, ice cream, and nutmeg. And olive oil ice cream with Venezuelan chocolate and red wine. And you pair with that a wine which Ann and Peter sampled at the vineyard. Can you remember which one it is?
Well,
I'm testing you, Charlie.
I'm sorry, which vineyard?
Which vineyard is it? Do you remember?
Gosh. I've been to so many vineyards, and I lose track. You're drinking wine at these vineyards, and that's impossible. That could have been at any one of the three or four places, and it could have been at...
Why don't you just say it?
Don't put me on. You're embarrassing me.
No, no, no.
Tell me
about it. Actually, there's a story that goes along with it, but it's Bodegas Torre Albala, mm-hmm. Don PX Grand Reserve, Pedro Jimenez from Montilla Morillas, 1971 year. We were at that vineyard. We had lunch with the export sales manager, Antonio Sogasso.
I was just about to say that, gosh darn it. Why don't you just give me another second?
the interesting thing, and Anne was horrified about this to begin with, was that Antonio, he decided that we should have Pedro Jimenez wines from Torre Albala with every course. So we started off with Electrico, and we finished up with PX, and the only person who finked out was Miss Anne. She said she really thought she should have red wine with the red meat.
Well, I don't like sweet wines very much, and I didn't realize how they're much drier. Well, I was even more horrified by the fact that he said we all had to start out by having a beer. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty horrifying.
And then the other wine I noticed is, and we drank this one together in Margaret River, and the wonderful Constellation apartment, Mosswood Cabernet Sauvignon from Western Australia. And I can't remember the dish that went with that, but I was absolutely amazed that this is a wine that you would have even reached out to find.
So sometimes we actually really push the envelope and serve seafood items with sort of big and lusty red wines, especially those from Australia. But again, with a few little touches, some bacon wrapped around the fish, some sautéed red wine mushrooms together as a bed underneath the fish, a little bit of meat juices, maybe some pieces of crispy sweet bread on the plate. Next thing you know, you've got a piece of bass or barramundi or something from the Australian seas that work perfectly with a robust and fruity red wine, and it's really great when you have that experience.
You know, we had this very funny experience in London. Is what restaurant was it where we had? They gave us a champagne, I think, to start with, and then for the appetizer course, they brought some kind of a cocktail.
Oh, that was Zuma. I didn't think that was a particularly good pairing.
I did not either.
a rather sweet cocktail with main course Thai inspired food.
It was terrible.
Didn't seem to me to go very well at all. But these are just some snapshots of what's available in this book called Lessons in Wine Service from Charlie Trotter for the home wine consumer. As well as for the restaurant sommelier or the restaurant manager, but it's a deceptively small book, and one that I think everyone should have in their collection. Now we're going to change direction now, because the other thing I think that you might perhaps have a reputation for, is making dishes that are very difficult for the home cook to reproduce, but you've proved that's wrong too.
Yes, we're talking now about home cooking with Charlie Trotter.
To make the cuisine appear so difficult that one would say, I'll never try this at home, I'll just go to the restaurant, it'll be much easier on me.
that's the plan.
No, I don't do that, I'm just teasing.
You know, we haven't and there's nobody out there that doesn't know that your flagship restaurant is in Chicago, called Charlie Trotter's. But anyhow, and it's also, you said, going into its 22nd year. I mean, it sets standards for restaurants. All that time, was it an immediate hit?
I don't know. You know, we opened and we were lucky to have a following locally from Chicago. I'm from here. And the year before we opened Charlie Trotter's, back in mid-87, I did prepared dinners in people's homes. And what I didn't realize then, I was just trying to stay in practice and sort of hone the dishes that would make up the opening menu. And I was sort of an accidental caterer. Never dreamed I'd be in the catering business that year before we opened. But what it did do was it built up a small groundswell of interest and folks that felt privy to what was happening before we had even opened. And so the day we opened, suddenly there was a small group of 500 people that wanted to kind of get in because they had had an experience in their home or at a friend's home. And so that served us well all those years ago. And well, we've been blessed. Ever since then, we've been busy and still trying to refine it and everything else.
Well, you have a takeout place, which is your dishes, but they're already prepared and ready to go, right?
That's right. It's called Trotter's To Go, and it's our version of, I know the common phrase is home meal replacement, but for folks that have time to cook, don't want to cook, don't know how to cook, don't want to be in a restaurant 3, 4, or 5 days a week, either because he's working, she's working, got to pick up the kids from after school, sports, or whatever, get home. Who's got time? Well, you can stop by Trotter's To Go. You're in and out in 5 minutes. It's the same philosophy as at the restaurant. Everything is naturally made, organic products. You can get hot food, cold food, salads, sandwiches, wine, desserts. You can make the entire meal, or you could make part of the meal, and we can give you things to finish the meal. So, but the key is you can be in and out in 5 minutes and have healthy, clean food, but not necessarily just gourmet food. It's not like that. It's meant to be a real working urban food marketplace.
It really ties in with this book because these are some basic but really well fine ingredients and well prepared dishes that anybody can do at home, more or less.
Exactly. Yeah, are in the home, home cooking book, and those dishes are the kinds of things you'll find at Trotter's To Go. Over the years, I've written these restaurant books that really feature what we do at Charlie Trotter's, and some of these dishes require 7, 8, 9 sub-recipes to even be done before you can execute the dish. Really, that's not meant for someone cooking dinner for the family after a hard day's work. It's meant to document what we do. So the last couple of books we've done have been more focused on how do we make the philosophy approachable for the home cook, basically.
Right.
Do you want to take a single recipe, Charlie, and just perhaps it has origins in your restaurant, but then talk about how you modified it to put in this recipe book and for people to be able to make it at home?
Sure. You want to give me a recipe or you want me to pick one?
No, pick one. Pick one. Pick one you're real familiar with. I tricked you on the wine. I tricked you on the wine service.
Oh,
you're
to be tricked.
You're entitled to pick this one.
Don't worry about that. Well, I'm gonna start with a dish. I'm gonna randomly just pick something, and it's whole roasted tomatoes with wild mushroom strewn quinoa.
Uh-huh.
Okay, quinoa is a grain from the Andes. It's not unlike couscous in its texture, although it's a little bit more toothsome. It's got a little bit more resistance. But here's a dish where we pick a mushroom a tomato, and we it's raw. We blanch it, remove the skin, we cut it open the top, scoop out the inside. We have a little mixture of this quinoa, or one could use couscous, or one could use barley, or one could use rice. That's the beautiful thing about our cuisine, is the idea of interchangeability of foodstuffs. And what we do is we make a little mixture of the quinoa, in this case, and we add some wild mushrooms and stuff the mixture inside the tomato, and then drizzle it with olive oil and roast it low temperature, 300 degrees for perhaps 20, 25 minutes until it just becomes soft, but everything sort of melts together. But the tomato stays just firm enough to contain the grain and the grain, you know, the mushroom-strewed grain. So that's the kind of thing that there would be a version of that that could exist at the restaurant, although it might be much more highbrow. The tomatoes might be quite petite, and they might contain five different little tomatoes, organic heirloom tomatoes, each one with a different grain, each one with a different mushroom, maybe some jelly of mushroom on the plate, different things. What we've done is we've deconstructed it, and we've made it, here's a way to do this thing, get the same flavors, and just have it as a simple home dish. So,
that's amazing. Very, very good, Charlie.
Now, we talked before we came on the air about your good friend Tetsuya from Sydney,
yes,
who you've worked with a lot, and I think you have a huge mutual admiration society going on. But who are some of the other chefs that really stand out in your view?
Your buddies.
Well, I'm not just in this line of work because I'm a restaurateur or a cook. I'm in this line of work because I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the great chefs and the great restaurants, and we've been blessed over the years to have so many chefs come and cook with us at Charlie Trotter's. We mainly for charity events, and we invite a European chef or an Australian chef or anyone else, an American chef. It's never for our own profit or gain. It's mainly for raising money for a worthy cause.
Right.
But for example, our 20th anniversary, which was about a year and a half ago.
Oh right.
We decided to invite literally some of the great chefs on the planet, and this event is like a lot of events, although it stands out just because of some of the headliner names, but. In no particular order, we had, if somebody were to say name the top 10 chefs in the world, we had seven of them at the restaurant cooking.
Uh-huh.
So we had Ferran Adrià from El Bulli in Rosas, Spain, Heston Blumenthal from the Fat Duck in Bray, England, Pierre Hermé, the great pastry chef, obviously Tetsuya, I mean, great friend and one of the geniuses, Thomas Keller from the French Laundry, Danielle Ballou.
What fun you must have had.
Oh, well, it was pretty crazy, and we had a lot of fun, and we raised a lot of money for charity, and
talk about your charities now. I mean, you were known for being philanthropic, but the one closest to your heart, could you explain the program with the Culinary Education Foundation?
Well, I think that most of us that are drawn into this world of food and wine are generous by nature because you're doing something that's very intimate for another person. You're cooking food, serving wine, providing service, these kinds of things, and that's a pretty extraordinary thing. So a lot of us that are asked to help out a cause, we're eager to do it. It could be to help a hospital or a children's museum or a local synagogue or so many worthy and amazing causes. But about 10 years ago, we started our own foundation, which benefits young folks that otherwise wouldn't have the means to go on to a culinary program unless they receive some sort of grant or stipend or scholarship from us. And so we've raised at this point about $1.5 million. Every dollar that we raise, we give away 50 cents. So we've given away about half of that amount of money. We're trying to build this fund into, if you will, a self-perpetuating sort of annuity that long after we're not around, maybe you can still give money. And but you see young folks, they're 18, 20 years old, they've gone through high school, maybe tried college, maybe have worked a little bit, and they'd like to go to culinary school, and they just can't quite afford the tuition. They can come to us, and again, we can provide the grant or the monies to help get them to where they need to go. So,
how does this interface with your school, where the schools come and
Well, now, those are two, thank you for the question, those are two real different things. Now,
yeah.
That's the foundation, and that's just an excuse to bring in great chefs and raise money and then give the money away. But the other part of the program is the Excellence Program.
Yes.
And that's completely underwritten by me personally and by the restaurant, where three nights a week for the last 10 years we've had Chicago public high school students come for what we refer to as the Excellence Program. And it's not necessarily about the culinary art or restaurant or the line of work of being in a restaurant. It's about... If the idea of in life you get what you give, and if you want a lot from life, you got to give a lot. You got to give a lot to your studies. You got to give a lot to any job you may have, and that nothing is ever beneath you. You could only be beneath it. You've got to embrace everything, even if you've got a job that you're not crazy about. maybe you're working at a convenience store behind the counter on a weekend. You know what? That's a great job, but give it all you've got. And every school determines who they want to send. So some schools send the honor roll students. Other schools send problem students, or one school sent the state champion wrestling team. Everybody sends somebody differently, or the French class, or the band. And 3 nights a week, every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night, 20 students, two or three teacher chaperones, arrive at the restaurant, go on a little tour, sit down at one big table in our studio kitchen, and they have a 10-course meal, and they hear from a dozen staff members. Pastry chef, fish cook, different people who talk about excellence and how they motivate themselves every single day to go to the next level. And then each one of our people fields 4 or 5 questions from these young students. And they're eating the same menu that's being served that night. They're eating sweetbreads. They're eating sea urchin. They're eating lamb's tongue. They're eating line-caught halibut. They're eating organic tiny carrots. Whatever's on the menu, they're having that menu. Some of these kids have never seen this before. They're like, they're taken aback. They're shocked.
Oh, many of them have never seen it before.
Well, I'm underestimating. Let's say most of these young men and women have never seen this before. And I'm going to say maybe 20% of the groups that come are actually in foods classes or intend to somehow or another get into the field of hospitality or gastronomy or food service or whatever it may be. But for the most part, there are young people that come, they don't know, invited by the school, and they're there. But again, it's not about, I mean, there are elements of etiquette and little lessons that happen along the way, but that's beside the point. What we're trying to do is instill this idea of excellence, and you have to take control of your own life. You're your own boss. You're your own toughest critic and your own toughest demander of excellence. And it's a great sight at 7:30 at night when a yellow school bus is pulling back up in front of the restaurant, vying for space with luxury automobiles and chef's limousines. And people are getting out of these cars saying, what's up with this school bus? Are we in the right place? We thought we were at the most expensive restaurant in America. What's this? And these students are tumbling out the door, giddy with excitement. I mean, it's pretty
Oh, you're amazing, Charlie. Absolutely. I mean, we have 10 million things to talk to you about. I did want to get in the fact that you just got back from Abu Dhabi.
Yes.
And what was going on there? Some gastronomy event?
Well, I had a chance. I've been to the Middle East before. I was with my colleague Rochelle Smith, who runs all of our business activities. And a couple of years ago, we took a around the world eating trip, where we left Chicago and flew west and kept going around the world, only to eat street food.
Oh,
so
my
goodness. We went to San Francisco, then to Sydney, Singapore, Shanghai, Dubai, New York City, and back to Chicago, eating street food every step of the way. So we were in Dubai about 3 years ago, and we said, this is really interesting. Hopefully one day we'll come back. Well, just about a week ago, we were back in that part of the world, specifically Abu Dhabi, for a gourmet summit. It was called Gourmet Abu Dhabi. A guy named Peter Knipp out of Singapore, who does the World Gourmet Summit out of Singapore every year, decided to stage this event. And it was really quite spectacular. They had chefs from different countries, one from Italy, one from Spain, one from Asia. We were from the U.S. Everyone was sort of housed at a different hotel. We were in the Emirates Palace, which you got to see this place to believe it.
Oh, I imagine.
The most expensive hotel ever built, a $3 billion hotel with only 400 rooms.
Wow.
Over the top. I mean, just beautiful, gorgeous. And we were there for just a few days, a dinner and a demonstration and some lectures and some things like that. So it was really spectacular. And,
well, I wanted to sign up for that trip.
Well, maybe next year
we'll
be back.
Good. Oh, yeah. Well, anyhow, I mean, I guess we're coming down to is there anything we should be looking forward to in your upcoming projects?
Well, we've got another book coming out, which is a sort of a compendium of our first works. And our restaurant works. This is very much for professionals, but it revisits dishes that we did 20 years ago, and it looks at them and we reanalyze and recreate those dishes, and you'll see the original image side by side with the current image, and the two things will look nothing alike, yet they'll be composed of identical ingredients. So it'll really be sort of let's just say an exercise in studying how creativity might work on more of a compendium as opposed to just in an isolated eureka or aha moment. This is more how creativity exists along a line where things evolve and change and move and move and move, a la Miles Davis. or Bob Dylan, where these artists take ideas and they revisit them and revisit them, and they seem to change just little by little, month by month, but over a period of time, they're unrecognizable based on how they approach certain things. So that book will be coming. It's probably about a year away. We're also opening a restaurant in New York City. In about 15 months.
Is that going to actually happen?
This is just between us. You can't announce this to the public.
Well, you,
I'm kidding. I know we're on it.
But where is it now? I mean, I did read about it. Where is it?
We're about 18 months away. It's under construction. It's happening right now. Obviously, there are tricky economic times, but that's not affecting us. But we've all long wanted to be in New York City, and
everybody wants to be in New York City.
Yeah, well, it's a great place just to be, but this is it's called One Madison.
That's right. You're on the park, are you?
That's the name of the building, and it's where Madison Avenue dead ends into 23rd Street.
You're gonna be across the street from Danny Meyer.
We are. My great personal friend Danny Meyer.
Yeah, we love
leaders.
Him too.
Yeah, known him for a long time. He and I started almost at the same time. I think he opened his first restaurant the year before we opened Trotters, but we've been great buddies for 22 years. But we're excited to be in that neighborhood. It's amazing. This is not a hotel type of project. This is a residential building, single restaurant that we're doing, and we're just looking forward to it. So.
And it's going to be called what again? One Madison.
The name of the building is One Madison, and I haven't decided yet what we'll call the restaurant. So.
Well, that's exciting news. I hope the economy does turn around, because we were just in Manhattan, and boy, I'll tell you, when really big, fabulous restaurants are running early bird specials, three courses for $35, I thought, oh dear.
That's
bad.
You know, it's tricky out there right now.
I know.
You gotta just do what you do even better than how you did it before. That's how.
Well, Charlie, it's been wonderful to have you on the program. What we're going to do is we're going to have to scheme another time and another part of your activities, because just in case there are on the menu listeners who are not interested in listening to Charlie Trotter for 30 minutes.
I've got about 2 more hours to go. literature.
Oh, Charlie, you're so much fun too.
And a great artist. So we've only scratched the surface here.
If you can, while we say goodbye to the On the Menu listening audience, if you can just stay with us on the line, that would be terrific. It's just been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and to learn more about this wonderful food personality, who does all kinds of good and writes wonderful books, which are helpful to everyone in the restaurant business or anyone who's interested in food and wine. So, Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today. On the Menu listeners, goodbye, and we'll be back with you in just a second, Charlie.